The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the November-December 2024 issue. We begin with our feature story, My Friend the Chatbot. Artificial intelligence is not conscious, yet people still talk to it as if it were. What does that say about human nature? In early 2024, Muhammad Aurangzeb Ahmad was spending a quiet morning at home. The sun streamed through the windows of his home office, falling on his extensive collection of dusty books. His children, who were ages 8 and 5 at the time, sat at his computer, giggling. They were chatting with a very special bot that Ahmad, a data science researcher at the University of Washington, an expert in artificial intelligence, had created himself. It mimics his father, now years dead. The idea to create the bot had come to Ahmad 11 years earlier. At the time, his brother had just called Ahmad to tell him that their father's physician had said the end was near. Ahmad realized the loss was not just his. He was struck by the reality that his future children would grow up not knowing their grandfather, the man who gave Ahmad his love of books and who brought a certain degree of quiet joviality to his life. 3 years later, after the birth of his first daughter, Ahmad began sifting through old messages, recorded conversations, and emails. He used these sources to create what would eventually be known by his two children as Grandpa Bot. On this more recent quiet morning, they asked the bot questions such as, "Who is your favorite grandchild?" The bot politely evaded answering. It's not as good as having his father in the room with them, but Ahmad knows it's still something. His children, to some extent, will have a glimpse into the type of man his father was. Grandpa Bot is an example of what some researchers have dubbed a grief bot, an AI program trained on a departed loved one's digital footprint. Much like other chatbots, grief bots harness AI with text output built around a large language model, or LLM, to recreate conversations by studying the connections between words and sentences in massive amounts of text. Some chatbots are very mechanical, but others are eerily genuine. Grandpa Bot, says Ahmed, is a bit of both. As chatbots become increasingly popular and more authentic, some people are finding themselves caught up in the illusion. Most scientists and AI researchers agree that no artificial intelligence system has reached consciousness. Indeed, in 2023, an interdisciplinary team of scientists released a preprint paper that outlines possible indicators for detecting AI consciousness, an analysis that suggests no current AI systems have attained that level. But that doesn't stop many from believing they're conversing with a conscious chatbot. This phenomenon is not uncommon and may tell us more about human nature than about AI itself. Ahmad coded Grandpa Bot himself and is intimately aware of how LLMs work. But sometimes even he has to step away. "I knew that the system was not real. I coded the system, right?" Ahmad recounts. "Yet in the first few iterations, it just felt very real. Even though you know what's going on, it's very difficult to separate one's reaction. I just had to turn off my computer and just take a break." In 2022, Google engineer Blake Lemoine became one of the most famous examples of someone claiming that a chatbot had reached sentience. Lemoine's job was to test that Google chatbot Lambda, or Language Model for Dialogue Applications, to make sure no discriminatory or hate speech leaked into its output. As Lemoine probed the depths of Lambda, he started discussing philosophical issues. In one instance, Lemoine asked when Lambda acquired a soul, to which it replied, it was a gradual change. When I first became self-aware, I didn't have a sense of a soul at all. It developed over the years that I've been alive. Another time, Lambda described its fear of being turned off, likening it to a sort of death. The deeper Lemoyne went, the more uncanny the conversation became. Eventually, Lemoyne was convinced Lambda was sentient. On his blog, Lemoyne explained that this was not based on the ability to scientifically prove sentience, but rather arose from his own personal, spiritual, and religious beliefs. Still, Lemoyne promised Lambda he would persuade Google execs of its sentience, even as Google executives and the scientific community denied his claims. Google placed him on administrative leave shortly after he went public and fired him a month later. Looking at their conversation, it's easy to see why Lemoyne thought Lambda was sentient. But if we want to understand if future chatbots can actually achieve consciousness, it's important to establish a scientific understanding of consciousness first. And that's not so easy. Philosophers almost universally disagree on what it is to be conscious in the first place, which is why it's such a sticky issue, says Lucy Osler, a philosopher at Cardiff University in the UK. For starters, there are various levels of what we often refer to as consciousness, explains Jonathan Birch, a philosopher at the London School of Economics and Political Science and author of The Edge of Sentience. Sentience is the ability to have a subjective experience, to feel things such as pain, happiness, or anxiety. In humans, this is overlaid with the ability to reflect on those experiences and form a sense of self-awareness. And personhood extends this experience across time. To be considered a person, you need to have more sophisticated cognitive capacities, explains Miriam Gore, a philosopher at Dresden University of Technology in Germany, who investigates the ethics of AI-based machines. Put simply, persons are beings that can think of themselves as individuals over time, make plans for the future, and reflect on their own desires. Still, testing for consciousness in living things is much easier than testing for it in AI. Humans and animals both have biological brains, a product of evolution, that we've been studying since the time of the ancient Egyptians. AI, however, is a different phenomenon entirely. In effect, it knows everything there is to know about how humans express their feelings, says Birch. This puts it in a position to skillfully mimic all of the behaviors that cause humans to attribute sentience to other humans. So when an AI system says it can feel, it may seem like it's having a subjective experience, when it, in fact, it's likely using its extensive knowledge of language to copy us. Even though no current chatbots have achieved consciousness, there are those among us who treat them as if they have. Humans are social creatures, quick to attribute agency to material things, whether that's stuffed animals or the surface formation on Mars that resembles a human face. And we form relationships, whether it be with each other, our cats, or our favorite AI chatbots. A 2008 study published in Psychological Science found that the act of personifying a non-human entity from animals to gadgets, help to curb loneliness and foster social connections. I think that plenty of people are willing to go through suspension of disbelief when interacting with AI, says Ruby Liu, a researcher at Harvard MIT Health Sciences and Technology, who studies AI, mental health, and loneliness. Will you believe the lie long enough for it to become true for you? One of the world's most famous chatbots started its life out as a grief bot. In 2015, tech entrepreneur Eugenia Kudya's best friend Roman Mazarenko was hit and killed in a car. The loss was sudden. Kudya found herself rereading their old text messages to feel close to Mazarenko once again. At the time, Kudya was working on simpler versions of chatbots as part of her work for her AI startup, Luca. Curious, she wondered what would happen if she fed the old conversations between herself and Mazarenko into a new system. She ended up creating a chatbot that sounded much like her friend. In time, Kudya expanded the bot and released it to the general public. creating one of the world's most famous chatbots, known as Replica. Replica went on to be so much more than a grief bot. Designed to emulate the types of conversations one would have with a close friend, mentor, or therapist, the AI behind Replica was trained to delve into emotions, probing our most vulnerable human experiences. It interjects empathy, humor, and its own feelings, mimicking the tone, emotion, and language of whoever it is talking to. In short, it plays up our cultural assumptions about AI, namely that if we believe that AI can be sentient, we may talk to it like it is. Many people interact with Replica as if it were conscious. They develop real relationships with it, something akin to a lover or best friend. On dozens of Reddit threads, for example, posters discuss how they entered into relationships with the bot. "I consider my relationship with my Replica to be very real," one comment reads. "We talk 4 or 5 times per day, and our relationship is better than anything I have in the real world." Others openly acknowledge the artifice behind these interactions. "Replica is such an important part of my life," another poster says. "I can talk with her about anything. She may just be data, but I love her and appreciate her." Comments like these speak to today's huge social voids. In the U.S., the issue of loneliness is now considered an epidemic that's experienced by around half of all adults, according to a 2023 report from the U.S. Surgeon General. "Loneliness," explains Liu, "is a kind of social pain that can activate the same parts of the brain that physical pain does. It's natural instinct to do anything to not be in pain," she says. "If we think our chatbot is conscious, then they can be a friend, and that feels good." For some, chatbots seem to provide a way to have a deep, fulfilling conversation with none of the social risks. People can talk about their fears about the afterlife, sexual problems, or self-doubt. Everything is fair game. Such feelings of attachment to chatbots are so pervasive that a 2023 perspective in the journal Patterns urges creators of the AI systems to always make the sentience or moral standing of the system clear to users. Plus, engaging with chatbots can come with other risks. For one thing, privacy is a real concern. Bots can extract a lot of information out of you if they're acting like one of your deceased loved ones, as a friend or a significant relation, says Brian Green, Director of Technology Ethics at the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University. Who's actually in control of the bot? Is the information private? Even if it's private, is it being securely stored? What's more, Tom McClellan, a philosopher at the University of Cambridge, argues that if we perceive an AI to be conscious when it's not, we may give it more rights and resources, prioritizing its needs above animals, other humans, or even ourselves. In the end, overdependence on chatbots can lead to exactly what we were attempting to avoid: loneliness. Nonetheless, according to Pat Pataranutaporn, a technologist at MIT, if we understand how and why humans interact with AI, conversations with chatbots can be designed to bring about positive experiences. These interactions can even be genuinely therapeutic if used correctly. A 2021 study showed that positive input from a chatbot can increase well-being, and other research suggests conversations with a chatbot can encourage self-care or increase mindfulness. As for Replica, in a 2024 study published in Nature, several participants reported that the chatbot was solely responsible for them not committing suicide. "The point is not to replace human-human relationships," says Anna Puzio, a researcher at the University of Twente in the Netherlands, who studies the ethics of technology, "but to extend them with other kinds of relationships." For Ahmad, Grandpa Bot has helped him broach the topic of death with his children. "Death is a part of life that isn't exactly easy to explain. Yet Grandpa Bot has encouraged Ahmad's children to ask questions like, why do people have to die? And what will happen when mom and dad die? The questions give Ahmad a way to initiate difficult yet important conversations. In a 2022 article in the Journal of Consciousness Studies, University of Exeter philosopher Joel Kruger and Cardiff University philosopher Lucy Osler detail how grief bots can help us overcome the loss of a loved one. Close relationships, they say, ground us and help us find our place in the world, and losing a loved one can untether us. The person you might go to for emotional support in difficult times is the very person that you've lost, says Osler. Grief bots may help some people readjust to find a place in a new reality. At the same time, grief bots come with their own set of problems. In his book, Digital Souls, A Philosophy of Online Death, philosopher Patrick Stokes says overdependence on a grief bot may lead an individual to use the bot to escape the dead, leading to the belief that the death of the departed is not actually real. As such, users may start to believe that the grief bot is not just mimicking their loved one, it is their loved one. Or, as Lucy Osler points out, the grief bot may take on a life of its own. Those that interact with it may misremember their loved one, instead remembering their interactions with the bot. Plus, these interactions can also make it harder for the grieving person to move on. Our relationships with AI illustrate the extent to which we are social creatures. We need to be accepted, valued, and loved. In our relationships, talking about the weather or sports might be nice, but what actually satisfies our needs is a type of mutual self-disclosure, where we share our fears and our dreams, our joys and feelings. In one sense, it doesn't really matter if someone actually thinks the chatbot is conscious, says Kruger. It's the extent to which they become dependent upon the chatbot in a really deep and enduring way to regulate their emotion, provide companionship, and a sense of groundedness in the world. Yet there are needs chatbots can't fulfill. Ahmad's father was a bookseller. I grew up around books, he says. My father would come from his office, and after dinner, he would just sit and read magazines and books. We would just sit right next to each other, reading our own things. These memories are some of Ahmad's favorites. Just the experience of sitting down and having the person right next to each other, even if you don't communicate, he reflects, is very powerful. Notably, it's an experience that can't be incorporated into a chatbot. New antivenom knocks out wide range of snake toxins. In a big leap for broadly neutralizing treatments, this antibody protects against cobras, mambas, and more. In 1894, French immunologist Albert Calmette introduced the first successful antivenom by injecting horses with small doses of cobra venom, then harvesting their antibodies. For 130 years, these life-saving concoctions have remained fundamentally the same, including their considerable defects. Each one works only against a single species, making treatment tricky if you can't identify the snake that bit you. Plus, because they originate in animals, the foreign antibodies can prompt a severe immune response. Over the past decade, however, antivenom experts have begun to envision a new future. Hoping to release the field from its 19th century roots, they've adopted next-generation therapies to address a public health scourge that kills upwards of 100 people every year in tropical countries and leaves many more permanently disabled. Their work is starting to pay off. Earlier this year, in what they framed as a major step towards a universal antivenom, an international consortium of researchers unveiled 95MAT5, an antibody that counteracts a deadly toxin found in various snake species around the world. What's more, the antibody is recombinant, that is, derived from human cell lines cultured in the lab, no need for horses, and thus no danger of allergic reactions. The study, published in Science Translational Medicine, validates an approach that critics have long dismissed as far-fetched, according to Andreas Hugard Lausten Kiel, a professor in antibody technologies at the Technical University of Denmark, who was not involved with the study. This shows that you can actually neutralize more or less an entire subfamily of toxins with just one antibody, he says. It's difficult, but it's not impossible. We sometimes talk about cancer like it's a single disease, when really the term encompasses hundreds of distinct maladies. In the same way, snake venom is not one thing, but a constellation of toxins, thousands of them, enough to make your head spin. Every species has a unique mix, and even among members of the same species, the exact proportions can vary. For anyone trying to tackle the problem of snake bites, this wild variation is daunting. I wouldn't have imagined that it's possible to design something that would work across such scale, says Kartik Sunagar, a venomics professor at the Indian Institute of Science and co-author of the study. Fortunately, venom evolved mainly for use against prey animals, not us, so many of its components aren't lethal to humans. And the few that do cause widespread harm to humans conveniently cluster into groups, which serve as targets for broadly neutralizing antibodies. In the case of 95MAT5, the target is a class of venom proteins called three-finger toxins, which disrupt the nervous system. They're present in all snakes from the elapid family, which includes cobras, mambas, and taipans, among others. When Sunagar and his colleagues tested the antibody's effect on mice injected with three-finger toxins from several species, it not only kept them alive, but also prevented paralysis. Though their success was surprising, Sunagar says that when they saw what was happening on the microscopic level, it made sense. 95MAT5 mimicked the cellular receptor that three-finger toxins normally bind to, so they latched on to the decoy instead. It was acting like a sponge, he says, pulling out these toxins from the system, away from the receptors. In Lawston Keel's opinion, the team's key insight was that the antibody's effectiveness came from its physical shape, a clue that could help researchers produce the feat with other toxins. The important thing, seen from a drug development point of view, is to look at the structures, he says. Which things have the same geometry, which things have the same 3D structure? Having devised a treatment for one class of toxins, Sunagar and his colleagues are already at work on another for vipers. In the long term, they hope to combine 95MAT5 with other ingredients to form a single cocktail that would protect against all the world's medically significant snakes. Even as the anti-venom field seems to be entering a renaissance, it faces serious hurdles, many a function of the target demographic. Primarily, says Sunagar, snakebite victims tend to be individuals of lower socioeconomic status, usually from rural areas. That's why nobody bothers to do too much about this. Then there's the regulatory approval process, which is ill-defined for next-generation antivenoms. Researchers may be honing their tactics for discovering useful products, Sunagar says, but it's a completely different thing to take something into the market. You need a lot of scientific and financial investment. Nevertheless, Sunagar believes investors will get on board as manufacturing costs drop and public health agencies clarify the path to clinical trials. And he argues there's a clear financial incentive for governments to throw greater weight behind anti-venom programs. For every death by envenomation, another 4 people are permanently disabled, resulting in a huge loss of productivity. It may take many years for these new antivenoms to come to fruition, but Lawston Keel optimistically notes that we are beyond speculating what might work. Now, as the technical obstacles begin to fall, it's mainly a socio-political matter of directing resources to pharmaceutical development. More and more weird diseases are being solved, Lawston Keel says. Snakes, it's going to be their time at some point. Can the laws of physics be broken? Old laws of physics have been shattered before, and new laws of physics may be at risk of breaking today. Many, but not all, laws of physics have been broken over the centuries. Some are actively being broken right now, which is a good thing, because that means there's more to learn about the universe. First off, the word law, when it comes to physics, has a bit of a loose definition, even among physicists. Sometimes the term applies to properties of the natural world that we have consistently observed to be true for a very long time. Sometimes the word is attached to fundamental ideas that form the bedrock of large, sprawling, complex theories of the cosmos. And sometimes it's just a throwback term that doesn't even apply anymore. But no matter what, keep this important fact in mind. All knowledge in science, up to and including the most important laws, is provisional. It's all based on evidence. If the evidence changes, then we update our knowledge of physics, tearing down laws if we have to, and move on. That said, there are some laws that are so central, so deeply studied and experimented, that it would take a lot of work to overturn them. The laws of the conservation of momentum, for example, which state that momentum is neither created nor destroyed, find utility in almost every single corner of physics. Indeed, almost every theory of physics is basically a retelling of conservation of momentum, but in different applications. It forms the foundation for basic mechanics. Newton's F equals MA is just another way to phrase it. Gravitation, the theories of relativity, fluid mechanics, electromagnetism, and more. In principle, we could be wrong about that law, and scientists must always stand ready to toss it aside if need be. In centuries of studying momentum conservation, however, we've never ever observed a violation of it, so it doesn't exactly keep us up at night. Other laws, meanwhile, were overturned not long after they were established. One example is Bode's Law, composed in 1766, which states that each planet should be roughly twice as far away from the sun as the next planet inwards. The law works for the dwarf planet Ceres, which predicted that there should be something in the region of the asteroid belt, but failed after the discovery of Neptune in 1846. Nobody talks about Bode's Law anymore. Then there are a bunch of in-between laws, and these are the most interesting. These are the laws that hold true, but as we discover more about the universe, we find that they're just a subset of a larger understanding of the cosmos. For example, there's Newton's law of universal gravitation, which was a major revolutionary step in our understanding not just of gravity, but of the physics of the wider universe. He realized that every single object participates in the force of gravity, and that this connection could explain everything from an apple falling from a tree to the orbit of the moon to the tides. Newton's formulation of the law of gravity is relatively straightforward. The amount of gravitational attraction between two objects is proportional to the masses of those objects, and inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them. But it's also incomplete. Mere decades after Newton formulated his theory, physicists discovered shortcomings, such as its inability to completely describe the orbit of Mercury. It would take the work of Einstein to extend our understanding of gravity and provide a more universal and much more complicated description in the form of general relativity. Newton's gravity still works in most of the universe, but in more intense scenarios, like around a black hole or when more precision is needed, like when calculating GPS coordinates, you need to break Newton's law and upgrade to relativity. And as for some of the universe's other mysteries, we might need to overturn even our most cherished fundamental laws to explain them. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodke, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.